Thanks for joining us. The Russian foreign minister has called the G20 summit in India a success after the bloc shied away from direct criticism of Moscow's war with Ukraine. Sergey Lavrov praised member states for not slamming Russia, saying that they managed to thwart the West's attempts to, quote, Ukrainize the summit agenda. He also hailed India, which currently holds the bloc's presidency, for what he called uniting G20 members from the global south. G20 leaders on Saturday peppered over deep divisions on Russia's 18-month-old war with Ukraine, alluding to the problems caused by the conflict, but not blaming Moscow. Kiev, meanwhile, denounced the summit. Russia says its forces have destroyed 8 Ukrainian drones and 3 speedboats in the Black Sea area near Crimea. Russia's defense ministry said in a statement that the speedboats were carrying Ukrainian forces and were intercepted northeast of the Snake Island. It did not give details on casualties or damages from the incidents. Separately, Ukrainian officials say the Russian military launched airstrikes across the capital, Kiev. The city's military administration says drone debris fell on several neighborhoods. Kiev's mayor also confirmed at least one injury from the attacks. Moscow has been launching near-daily airstrikes on Ukrainian territory in recent weeks, as Ukraine has stepped up its own drone attacks on Russian targets and cities, with both sides claiming to repel most of the assaults. Of course, one of the Moscow, Johnny Miller, earlier gave us a deeper look into what Ukrainian attacks on Russian forces near Crimea could entail.
Well, yes, it seems that Ukraine is continuing to attack Crimea. This is part of a broader aim of NATO to try to destabilize Russia. Indeed, this entire war is largely an attempt to try to destabilize Russia. So it's not the first time. It looks like perhaps that Ukraine has tried to land troops in Crimea. They've done that before with not much success. It's difficult to see what kind of strategy they are pursuing here. Ukraine is a very militarized area, a large area, so it's difficult to see what the exact aims are, but Russia has such great defensive capabilities there. They're able to dispel most attacks, but almost on a daily basis, Ukraine attacks in some form or another Crimea, either with drones or increasingly trying to land men on the island, but Russia usually is able to dispel these attacks. So we're certainly moving into a new stage, and we expect that these attacks in Crimea and mainland Russia, if you like, by Ukraine, will only continue. But it's also important that particularly the Anglo-Americans, British and the Americans, have an obsession with Crimea. And the fear is that they're trying to edge, if you like, nuclear war, and by continuing to try and attack Crimea. There's been some strong words from Medvedev, former Russian Prime Minister, about these attacks and the potential of the greater escalation it could lead to.
The United States is now sending depleted uranium tank shells to Ukraine, even though they were widely blamed for increasing cancer and birth defects in Iraq. It is the latest escalation in which Washington is resorting to as the Russian military continues to prevail against the Ukrainian counteroffensive. Ramin Mazari has more from Chicago.
The United States announced they are sending depleted uranium shells for tanks to Ukraine, even though they pose the risk of serious civilian health issues for generations. The use of such toxic shells by the United States in Fallujah, Iraq, is often blamed there for an increase in cancer, birth defects, and infant mortality. Depleted uranium shells now follow F-16 fighter jets, cluster munitions, tanks, and other escalatory measures which Washington had said they would refrain from using in the conflict.
Piles that much more of an atrocity on the atrocities that we're already committing, the atrocity of overthrowing the democratically elected leadership of Ukraine and forcing it into a 9-year race war, is a horror that should have taught Americans long before this that their government does not care about Ukraine, does not care about Russia, and it's a hard pitch to say that they care about America either.
The toxic shells were announced during a surprise visit to Kiev by the United States Secretary of State, where he announced another $1 billion in funding.
The new security funding that we're announcing today will also be bolstered by the arrival of U.S. Abrams tanks this fall and by training for Ukrainian pilots on F-16s in the United States, complementing training that is already underway in Europe. In the ongoing counteroffensive, progress has accelerated in the past few weeks. This new assistance will help sustain it and build further momentum.
So far, the U.S. has given some $80 billion to Ukraine, or an average of nearly $1 billion per week since the unrest increased in February 2022. All the Western military aid has so far failed to succeed. The Ukrainian counteroffensive has barely dented Russian defenses. Western tanks often smolder on the battlefield. U.S. leaders now admit the war will continue for years. The obvious Russian success has many questioning the alleged military supremacy of the United States and NATO.
I think that there's no way that the West can win this war, and we're not fighting it to win it. We're fighting it to wear Russia down, using Ukraine as our blunt instrument to wear Russia down, smashing our friends, our allies, into the brick wall in hopes of knocking a few bricks out. But the narrative that has been sold to, is being relentlessly sold to Americans, is that we're on the verge of winning.
Congress is currently negotiating a bill for another $20 billion in weapons, even as polls show 55% of Americans don't want more funding for Ukraine. The influx of money has led to such rampant allegations of bribery that it just forced the replacement of Ukraine's Minister of Defense. Ramin Mazahari, Chicago.
New strike by airline and airport personnel has caused widespread disruptions in Italy, with tens of flights delayed or canceled. Max Cibili has the details from the Italian capital, Rome.
On Friday, a 24-hour national strike was called. A number of base unions representing airline personnel, airport workers, and ground handlers in Italy. As a result of the industrial action, over 100 domestic and international flights were cancelled, with great delays recorded in a number of airports, including those of Milan, Venice, and Verona. It was the 18th strike involving airport and airline personnel in Italy this year. Travelers are feared that they are left bearing the brunt of the clash between aviation sector companies and their workers.
They are not able to find a mutually satisfying deal. It must be said that workers have been deprived of their social rights over the past years.
I'm from Madrid. I just got here. I don't know if I'll be able to reach my destination today. It's very annoying.
Aviation sector workers have gone berserk as airline fares have skyrocketed over the past year and their salary levels have remained the same, if not worsened.
Union's main demand concerns airport ground service workers' collective agreement covering wages. The latest contract expired 6.5 years ago. In the meantime, inflation has really eaten into wages.
In our airports, we've got insecure, low-paid jobs which push workers into poverty. Some employees are forced to accept part-time jobs for less than 800 euros a month. Some others have to pay for parking their car in the workplace car parking areas, let alone their undignified working conditions. The logic behind this is the same as usual. Services offered at the cheapest rate. We have left the market in the hands of companies, and this is the result.
Goods and services prices in Italy have gone up dramatically since the start of the war in Ukraine. The 2022 annual inflation rate stood at over 8 percentage points, the highest level since 1985. Inflation stands at 6% today. A combination of high cost of living, skyrocketing costs of borrowing money, and insufficient fiscal support has caused a crunch that is felt at nearly every level in the country. Max Cibili, Rome.
Niger Junta says France is planning a military intervention in the country in collaboration with the regional bloc known as the Economic Community of West African States. Niger's rulers say that France is deploying forces and military equipment in several ECOWAS countries as part of preparations for the aggression. The former colonial power France refuses to recognize the military government in Niger, which took power after ousting President Mohamed Bazoum in July. France currently has about 1,500 soldiers stationed in the country. Niger's leaders have renounced several military cooperation agreements with Paris and say that French forces are now illegally stationed in Niger. Thousands of people have also held several gatherings around the military base housing French soldiers in the capital, Niamey, to demand their departure. Search and rescue operations are underway in Morocco to find survivors of a deadly earthquake that has claimed over 2,000 lives. Morocco's Interior Ministry says efforts are in full swing as the army, security services, and civil protection are mobilized to provide immediate relief. Local officials say that most deaths are in mountain areas that are hard to reach. The magnitude 7.2 quake struck in Morocco's high Atlas Mountains on Friday. Buildings have collapsed, historic sites damaged, and countless residents rushed from their homes in the country's deadliest tremor since at least the year 2004. The first court session has been held in the trial of those charged with involvement in a deadly terrorist attack on a holy shrine in southern Iran. Three of the defendants, along with their attorneys and the next of kin of those martyred in the attack, were present at the trial where the indictment was read out. Defendant number one is of Tajik nationality and, by his own confession, a member of the Daesh terrorist group. He was charged with acting against national security, among other things. The other two defendants were charged with being accessories to acting against national security in collusion with Daesh. The Shah Cheragh Holy Shrine in the city of Shiraz in Fars province came under a terrorist attack nearly a month ago. It was the second such attack on the shrine in less than a year. Tens of thousands of Israelis are back on the streets for the 36th consecutive week to protest against controversial judicial curbs by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme far-right cabinet.
This is the 36th week in a row that we're demonstrating against Netanyahu's attempt to make a coup in Israel and make it a dictatorship. This demonstration is 3 days before the deliberations in the Supreme Court to disable the law that they passed right now.
Mass protests against the judicial overhaul, described by protesters as a judicial coup, have been ongoing since it was proposed back in January. The Israeli Supreme Court began hearing the first in a series of appeals linked to the plan in August. It set off an unprecedented domestic crisis, resulting in public unrest, labor strikes, and mutiny by some members of the military. Critics say the move removes vital checks on the far-right cabinet's powers. They say that they will continue with the protests until they are able to repeal the legislation. The Supreme Court will hear an appeal against the case on September 12th. The U.S. delegation, comprised of Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Ethan Goldrich and a military officer, has paid what Damascus has called an unauthorized visit to Syria. The delegation has held meetings with foreign-backed terrorists, including the Syrian Democratic Forces, or the SDF.
A recent visit by U.S. delegation led by Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Ethan A. Goldrich to northeastern Syria has drawn outrage from Damascus. In a statement, the Syrian Foreign Ministry branded the entry of the delegation to the country's territory as unauthorized. The ministry categorically condemned the visit as what it called flagrant violations of Syria's sovereignty and a breach of international law and the United Nations Security Council resolutions. That after the delegation, led by Goldrich and a military officer, met with commanders of U.S.-backed militant groups, including Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, and tribal leaders earlier in September in the eastern province of Deir ez-Zor. The ministry said the delegation's meeting further exacerbated concerns regarding Syria's sovereignty and international legal principles. The ministry dismissed the delegation's claim that their visit was aimed at addressing issues faced by residents in Deir ez-Zor, calling it a blatant lie. It said the event underscores the hypocritical stance taken by U.S. administration. The Syrian Foreign Ministry stressed that U.S. is actively exploiting Syria's resources and capabilities while at the same time imposing unilateral economic sanctions, describing the measures as unjust, illegitimate, inhumane, and immoral. The ministry asserted that the U.S.'s blatant interference in Syria's domestic affairs, along with its extensive support for various terrorist groups and separatist militias, only serves to underline the destructive role played by Washington in the Arab country. The reaction by the Syrian government comes as U.S.-backed militant groups hold control to the east of the Euphrates River, while the Syrian government forces are positioned on the western bank. The United States also maintains military installations in the area, including the country's largest gas field, Alomar.
The recent visits by American delegations to Syria bring to the spotlight Washington's real intentions behind such trips. Is it, as Secretary General of the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah says, reviving terrorists to justify its presence? Or is plundering Syria's oil and gas reserves? Or maybe both?
The visit led by Goldrich and a U.S. Army officer to Syria follows another trip by an American delegation to the country's northwest last month. The high-level delegation included three members of the U.S. Congress, Ben Klein, Scott Fitzgerald, and French Hill, all members of the U.S. Republican Party, who visited parts of Aleppo province with a claim of highlighting the ongoing humanitarian catastrophe there. But the interesting point about the U.S. delegation's recent trips is that all those visits were made to areas controlled by foreign-backed terrorists and not ordinary areas. The recent visits also come in the light of Washington's all-out support for foreign-backed militants there. For over a decade, the United States has left no stone unturned to provide financial and logistical support to the terrorists, including Daesh, with the aim of overthrowing the democratically elected president of Syria. Reports on the ground indicate that the United States has recently increased its support for the terrorist groups in parts of Syria controlled by foreign-backed militants. Testimony to that is the deadly terror attacks carried out by Daesh over the past months. The most recent incident occurred on August 10th when Daesh terrorists ambushed a bus in Deir ez-Zor province, resulting in the tragic loss of 32 Syrian soldiers. Concurrently, despite the existence of U.S. coalition-controlled camps in Syria, particularly Al-Hawl camp in Hasakah province, which functions as a primary detention and holding facility for Daesh terrorists, the activities of the terror group have surged. Some Lebanese media have cited Russian officials that the U.S. support for Daesh terrorists in certain areas in Syria has significantly increased. Maybe that is why the Secretary General of the Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah has talked of U.S. plans to revive Daesh in an effort to justify its role in the West Asia region. All what it is that U.S. intentions to provide as much support to the terrorists as it can are not secret to anyone. But the real intention is, as the Syrian government has numerously complained about, to plunder the country's resources, including its oil and gas reserves.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. This is bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Reasons behind enemies targeting Islam is the political rules of Islam. This is the part of a speech delivered by the leader of Islamic Revolution in a meeting with the Supreme Assembly of Commanders and officials of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps on August 17, 2023. In the Imam Khomeini's Hosseiniyeh. One of the important things that we must continuously focus on is guarding ourselves. We all have weaknesses. Every human being has flaws within their own selves. Some of these weaknesses lie hidden in the internal layers of a person's mind and spirit. If these find a situation where they can emerge, they will emerge. Some of us have a passion for money and some of us love gaining a higher rank. There are all kinds of lusts and desires that attract us. Sometimes we are neglectful about these. That is, we are neglectful about these traits most of the time. if one finds an opportunity to emerge, it will emerge and overcome us. If we do not fight it, it will overcome us and knock us down. We must guard ourselves. The values and prominence of the IRGC is very valuable. These must be protected and guarded. Officials of various ranks in the IRGC should be active, sensitive, careful, and concerned in these fields.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
If remembering God is neglected, this threat will become even greater. If there is less selfless jihadi motivation for any reason, these threats will become greater. If we become arrogant because of our accomplishments, we will face a greater threat. These are the risk factors: forgetting God, becoming arrogant because of the achievement, getting tired of jihadi work, not paying attention to God's blessings, not remembering the great blessings that God has given us, and losing hope as soon we face a difficulty. When we face a problem, we tend to forget that Almighty God has solved hundreds of our problems, and that is another one of these problems. What significance does it have? We have been taught in prayers, O Allah, your light is complete, so you guide it. Praise be to you, you our Lord. Your hand is extended, so you gave and blessed. Praise be to you, our Lord. Your patience is immense, so you forgave. Praise be to you, our Lord.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
As the war in Ukraine lingers on, there are concerns among some Eastern European countries over possible peace talks between Russia and Ukraine. Eastern European countries are raising alarm over Ukraine potentially being pushed into peace talks with Russia. This amid hesitation and delays in weapons supplies to Kiev and waning public support. The countries bordering Russia and Belarus argue that international partners need to lay out a path for a decisive victory for Kiev. Some Republican presidential candidates, including frontrunner and former President Donald Trump, have called for the U.S. to directly negotiate with Vladimir Putin and relegate the war to a territorial dispute.
So we've been pretty consistent, actually, on all this. We need to end this war, no blank check. Europe needs to step up. And anything we do should be in America's national interest. You don't subcontract out your national interests to other countries And I don't think it's been in our interest to be sending money to pay pensions for Ukrainian bureaucrats and salaries for Ukrainian bureaucrats.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has insisted that any deal must pressure Russia into a full retreat of Ukrainian territory and security guarantees. The concern comes amid calls in Europe to make some sort of a security agreement with Russia. French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna has said Western leaders will need to build a security architecture that respects Russia's interests when the conflict in Ukraine ends. Reality, history, and geography mean that this country is largely on the European continent. We will have to find a way to rebuild a solid security architecture that takes into account the stability interests of all. Colonna's statement does not mark a radical departure from French policy since the start of the conflict. French President Emmanuel Macron has held since last year that Europe should discuss, quote, how to give guarantees to Russia the day it returns to the negotiating table. However, both Macron and Colonna continue to endorse Ukraine eventually joining the NATO bloc, which Moscow would consider an unacceptable security threat. Meanwhile, Ukrainian lawmakers have overwhelmingly voted to relieve Alexei Reznikov of his duties as defense minister. He has earlier tendered his resignation after President Volodymyr Zelensky announced plans to replace the official. Reznikov had held the post since November 2021. During his tenure, the defense ministry was embroiled in several corruption scandals. Senior officials were accused of procuring food for soldiers at inflated prices and paying dubious firms for supplies. One recent scandal involved a regional conscription chief who was charged with obtaining millions of dollars in illicit funds.
The money which is stolen or could be stolen from the state budget, this money is stolen from the war effort. So it means just like the soldiers on the front line, they do not receive necessary equipment or goods if the money goes somewhere else.
President Zelensky has appointed 41-year-old Crimean Tatar Rustem Umerov, who most recently led Ukraine's state property fund, to replace Reznikov. Experts have observed that the cabinet reshuffle is unlikely to lead to any major change in Ukraine's battlefield strategy. The dismissal comes amid Ukraine's ongoing counteroffensive against Russia. Ukrainian military officials claim their troops have made progress in the front line near the Zaporizhia region. Russian military officials have not commented on the claim, but they say Ukraine has lost a considerable number of troops and military hardware in the counteroffensive.
Yes, well, this counteroffensive has been much hyped for months before it even started. And I think it's fair to say that progress has been slower than hoped for by Kiev and certainly by some of its Western backers. It had a slow and sort of a rough start with a lot of Western equipment lost and Ukrainian lives lost. That's because the Russian defensive lines were really entrenched, very heavily mined, several layers deep.
Russian officials say Kiev's forces have lost more than 66,000 troops and over 7,600 heavy weapons since launching their push in early June. Defense Minister Shoigu says despite the colossal cost in manpower and equipment, the Ukrainian government continues its operation because it desperately needs to show some kind of success to its Western sponsors. Ukrainian officials have acknowledged that their counteroffensive was proceeding poorer than had been hoped and is being waged at a serious cost to the army.
Former head of Israel's Mossad spy agency has said the occupying entity enforces an apartheid system against Palestinians. The admission has been made by Tamir Pardo, who was the regime's spy master from 2011 to 2016.
Let's say there is a car accident between a car of a Jewish settler and a car of a Palestinian who lives in Hebron or Nablus. Each one of them stands before a different legal system, one under the military legal political system and the other, the civilian system. In a territory where two people are judged under two legal systems, that's an apartheid state.
Pardo becomes the latest former senior official to have concluded that Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank amounts to apartheid. That's a reference to the system of racial separation in South Africa that ended in 1994. Leading rights groups in Israel and abroad, as well as Palestinians, have accused Israeli occupation of the West Bank of morphing into an apartheid system. A handful of former Israeli leaders and diplomats have warned that Israel risks becoming an apartheid regime, but Pardo's language was even more blunt. Israel has been practicing an apartheid system against Palestinians, though far more brutally, since 1948. This is when, with the support of Western governments, Zionist terrorists claimed Palestine to be their homeland. Israel launched another war in 1967, occupying more Palestinian territory, such as the West Bank, including East al-Quds, that Palestinians want as the capital of their future state. Since then, Israeli apartheid authorities have created a judicial system that allows them to steal more Palestinian homes and land and dispossess them in order to make way for more illegal settlers. Rights groups have pointed to the discriminatory policies within Israel and in occupied East al-Quds, its blockade of the Gaza Strip, which has been ruled by the Hamas group since 2007, and its occupation of the West Bank.
Because the U.S. was the last pillar to fall, the last domino to fall in sustaining apartheid in South Africa, where it had to fall in line with everyone else. But during apartheid South Africa and the international campaign against it, during that regime's tenure, the United States issued the most vetoes within the Security Council to protect apartheid there, just to protect apartheid in Namibia and South Africa. And here we're seeing a similar pattern.
Meanwhile, it has been revealed that Israeli female soldiers have forced Palestinian women to strip naked in front of their children during a night raid on their homes. The revelation has been made by the Israeli human rights organization Bet Salam. According to the report, soldiers threatened to unleash dogs on the families if the women did not comply. Regime forces broke into the Al-Luni family's house in the early morning of July 10. Two female troops took the 53-year-old mother, her 17-year-old daughter, and the mother's three daughter-in-laws, all in their 20s, into the children's room where they were forced to undress. The incident happened in the city of Al-Khalil. Well, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation has strongly condemned the move. The OIC urged international bodies to put pressure on Israel to end its daily breaches of human rights in Palestine and to take legal action with the appropriate international authorities. A coalition of Palestinian resistant factions has strongly condemned the use of attack dogs by female Israeli soldiers to force Palestinian women to strip naked, calling for a revolution in response to the regime's degrading behavior towards Palestinians. The United Nations has also called for an investigation into the forced stripping of Palestinian women by Israeli soldiers. Additionally, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, has said that such incidents are absolutely appalling.
The United States is not just a bystander here. The United States is complicit and a pillar of Israeli apartheid in its provision on unequivocal financial, diplomatic, and military support. That but for that support, Israel could not sustain this regime.
Israel exerts overall control of the territory, maintains a two-tier legal system, and is building and expanding Jewish settlements. Furthermore, Israel has broken a 30-year record for the number of Palestinians unlawfully detained under the highly controversial administrative detention procedure. The practice allows Israeli authorities to detain Palestinians without charge or trial indefinitely. The number of administrative detainees is reaching 1,264, breaking the record of 1,108, which was set in March of 2003, during the Second Intifada.
Mm-hmm. Israel's foreign minister has agreed with his Bahraini counterpart to boost trade relations during his first visit to one of the two Persian Gulf Arab states to establish ties with Israel.
His Excellency, my friend, the foreign minister, and I agreed that we should work together to increase the number of the direct flights, the tourism, the trade volume, the investment.
Cohen made the remarks during a ceremony to inaugurate Israel's new embassy in Bahrain on Monday. The embassy in the capital, Manama, will replace the first embassy Israel opened in 2021, a year after it normalized diplomatic relations with Bahrain as part of the United States brokered Abraham Accords, which were also signed with the United Arab Emirates, Morocco, and Sudan. Monday's ceremony was attended by Bahraini Foreign Minister Abdul Latif Al-Zayani, who said the new embassy assumes a pivotal role in growing collaboration between Manama and Tel Aviv.
I welcome the opportunity for fruitful and constructive discussions with Foreign Minister Cohen, reflecting our shared desire to further advance our bilateral relations across the broadest range of fields, including economic, investment, trade, and other areas of cooperation.
Cohen arrived in Bahrain on Sunday, accompanied by a business delegation of more than 30 companies working in high-tech, logistics, and real estate. Earlier on Monday, he met Crown Prince Salman bin Hamad Al Khalifa and discussed the importance of advancing a free trade agreement and projects to connect youths in Israel and Bahrain. His visit, initially scheduled for early August, was postponed by Bahrain last month in response to one of the frequent raids of Al-Aqsa Mosque by far-right Israeli minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. Cohen's trip to Manama is the first one by an Israeli official in the current far-right cabinet. This is also Cohen's first official trip since his office set off a diplomatic firestorm with Libya last week after his office unilaterally disclosed details of a secret meeting he held with former Libyan Foreign Minister Najla Mangouche in Italy. The revelation set off protests across the North African nation and led to the firing of Mangouche, who was also forced to flee to London. The opening of the Israeli mission in Bahrain took place 3 years after the Al Khalifa regime and United Arab Emirates signed U.S. brokered normalization agreements with Israel in an event in Washington. Sudan and Morocco also followed suit and inked similar U.S. brokered normalization deals with the occupying regime. The Bahraini people have repeatedly expressed their opposition to the normalization of ties with the Israeli regime by holding demonstrations. Bahrain's main opposition group, Al-Wefaq, and the kingdom's top cleric, Sheikh Isa Qasim, have also repeatedly condemned the normalization move by the Al-Khalifa dynasty. The move has sparked widespread condemnations from the Palestinians, as well as nations and human rights advocates across the globe, especially within the Muslim world. Palestinians slammed the deals as a treacherous stab in the back and a betrayal of their cause against the decades-long Israeli occupation of Palestinian territories.
Leaders of Palestinian-Lebanese resistance movements have gathered together in Lebanon's capital, Beirut, to discuss a range of issues including anti-Israeli operation by Palestinian groups as well as Tel Aviv threats. The meeting brought together Secretary General of Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement, Ziad al-Nakhala, head of the Hamas political office, Saleh al-Aruri, and Secretary General of the Lebanese Hezbollah Movement, Said Hassan Nasrallah. The three leaders exchanged views on latest political developments in the occupied Palestinian territories, as well as recent Israeli threats. The resistance leaders underlined their unwavering and bedrock support for all resistance groups encountering Israeli occupation. The meeting between resistance leaders comes at a time when tensions are high across the region due to Israeli policies. The occupied Palestinian land, Nablus and Jenin in particular, have been the scene of the regime's raids, resulting in a large number of fatalities. Israeli regime forces attacked Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank on July the 3rd, murdering at least 12 Palestinians. They also injured up to 100 others. Some 500 Palestinian families were forced or had to leave their homes due to the Israeli deadly assault. The regime has also carried out numerous raids in the occupied Al-Quds, with settlers backed by Israeli forces killing and injuring Palestinians. Many have described the Israeli intention to carry out those raids in the occupied Al-Quds as seeking to tighten the grip on Palestinian people. But Tel Aviv has not sufficed to that. Israeli officials have made numerous comments calling for more pressure against Palestinians. One significant instance was the Israeli far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, who repeatedly called for exerting pressure on Palestinian detainees, which has resulted in inmates languishing in regime jails to start hunger strikes to protest the growing Israeli violence. The growing Israeli violence in the occupied territories have simply resulted in rising anti-Israeli operations, with stabbing attacks, rocket strikes, and other sorts of operations being reported almost on a daily basis. Those attacks are only in response to calls by resistance leaders to enhance anti-Israeli operations across the occupied land. Such calls have made the regime officials to threaten to assassinate Palestinian resistance leaders, blaming them for the intensification of resistance against Tel Aviv. Palestinian Hamas movement has reaffirmed that Tel Aviv's threats to assassinate resistance leaders will lead to a confrontation and that the regime will pay its price. The Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine has echoed Hamas' warning, stressing that Israeli threats will only increase Palestinian people and fighters' determination to adhere to the option of resistance in words, actions, and behavior, and to insist on responding to any crime the Israeli regime plans to commit. Additionally, the spokesperson for the Palestinian Freedom Movement, Yasser Khalaf, said that such threats do not frighten the Palestinian people and will not impact the strategy of enhancing and developing the resistance strength and performance. He sent a message to the Israeli leaders not to make wrong calculations regarding the situation, as what awaits them will be far greater than expected. Those calls have been reiterated by Said Hassan Nasrallah, who just recently said that Israel will be returned to the Stone Age if it goes to war with Lebanon. Taking a brief look at those remarks, what they all have in common is that Palestinian resistance is determined to stand firm against Israeli atrocities. This also shows that the resistance has expanded beyond the occupied territories and will continue to expand day after day to the extent which can endanger the future of Israeli occupying regime.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio. With you every single moment.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the pitch.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In your name we shall start all the stories. Yes, assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, my dear sisters and brothers from every nook and cranny of this huge world. Welcome back to a new episode of Youth Station. Well, I'm Asma, and here with me...
Assalamu alaikum, my name is Abu Zahra, happy to be here.
Yeah, well, we're again in the Youth Station, and I'm sure we're going to have an amazing session again, because Youth Station is always amazing. What kind of a person you are? As for me, I would say I'm
an overthinking person.
Yeah. What do you mean by that?
Tiny matters in this life might sound tiny to people, but then to me, they're not so tiny.
They're a big deal. Yeah. Isn't that the case for a lot of people, though?
Yeah, it's been so like this, so common for everyone.
Okay.
Every single person I see, they're mostly these kind of people who think, who overthink about every single trivial, even issues.
Is it a problem? Isn't it a good thing to think about things?
No.
Don't take rash decisions,
right? It's not always a good thing to think too much about everything. Like I told you, there are some certain things that are trivial. They do not need to think too much about them. But some certain people like me, including me, would go through too much of thinking for those trivial things.
Why do you think that's the case? Firstly, I actually think that people don't think enough. But maybe we're so busy overthinking about the trivial matters that we don't think enough about the important matters. Because I meet youths quite often, and we discuss a lot of things. And I often find that people don't think about the important things of life. Even important decisions that they make, they don't think about them, right? So sometimes, you know, it's a bit frustrating that people don't think. And then here we are talking about how people overthink about trivial matters. So there's something going wrong, obviously, in the society, and that needs to be looked into. Why is this happening? Why do you think it's happening? Why do you think people overthink things?
Well, I guess because life has been so stressful for everyone, and maybe trivial things, which do not have too much of value, has got so much of importance in our lives. Maybe the worries of the future are too much and the regrets of the past are too much that we lose the track of right now and the present moment that we're living in. Yeah. And maybe, you know, there are too many factors for overthinking.
So I actually think the reason we overthink is I think we have too much choice. We have too much freedom. That's what I think, at least. We have too much choice, and so we spend too much time thinking about small and petty things. Whereas if the choice of things was reduced, if things were much simpler, if life was much simpler, yeah. I think we would think less about trivial matters and we would put time for more important things.
I agree, right? But it's still...
So there's so many small things you want to... Yeah. Like literally, like, you know, for a small thing you need to buy in the house, okay, you're going to go through Amazon or eBay or whatever, wherever you're living.
You search and search.
And you search and search, and then you have all these cheap brands and you're like, which one should I get? How many reviews? And okay, this review is good, but there's one bad review, so I'm going to just get the thing.
You know?
It's a small item for your house. Just buy it. It's not that expensive either.
Yeah, just go for it.
Yeah, there's so... I feel... And that happens in so many different things in life, right? Because I feel we're just overstimulated with choices, with different things. Mm-hmm. And that just makes us very sensitive to small things.
Yeah, you know? we've turned into these picky kind of people.
And like you said, it's not random. It's not like we like to do that. It's because of the bad experiences in the past of certain things and the fear of the future. Then we want to make sure that in all these things, oh, what if I buy this and it comes out, you know, it's bad. It doesn't turn out to be as good as it says, or it comes faulty, or this or that. So it's sort of like our bad experiences in the past tying into the amount of choice that we have. And I just think it leads us to going crazy.
Well, dear folks, all the overthinkers from all around the world, stay tuned. We have more to talk about for overthinking.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
So perfectionism is also another reason of why people overthink different things. You know, when you get to be a sort of a picky person, when you try to make everything look perfect, when you try to do the best of your effort, then I guess you would turn into this overthinker that would be engaged with too much of thinking over everything. Because I want everything to be perfect and I want to be a perfect human being. I want to be perfect in everything. So this is sad and this would lead to overthinking. Yeah.
But this kind of perfection is not really human perfections, right? If you think about it, it's more about worldly matters, which actually don't matter to us as human beings.
Yeah,
I think it's a lot about us overthinking because of us giving importance to what people think about us.
You mean it's a sort of meaningless overthinking?
Yeah, they're not. We never overthink
about
how.
It's leading to nowhere.
Yeah, we never overthink about our generosity, about our kindness, about our ability to forgive. You know, things that really make us real human beings, right? We overthink about the small issues that are mundane, that are worldly, physical things, right?
Yeah.
About our possessions and about these kind of things. And I feel that's because of this culture of comparing ourselves to others and being judged and judging people.
Yeah, this is very important.
Right? And this is where we become very sensitive about how we do things, what we do, what we possess, how our house looks like, what we look like, you know, our clothing, you know, small things like this, because we're constantly feeling that we're being watched and we're being judged.
Exactly.
So I think that also leads to that.
So comparing myself to others, and then the fear of being judged.
Some, for example, you know, you want to buy something, you're scared that, you know, you buy it and it turns out to be bad and you look like a fool in front of your friends or in front of your family. Mm-hmm. And so you start overthinking things.
Or even in front of yourself, you feel like, okay, I would regret it.
I would regret that, yeah. But if we think about it in the bigger scheme
scale.
Of things, in larger scale, that doesn't really matter.
Exactly.
It doesn't make me less of a human being.
If I do a mistake of buying something not so good.
Yeah, or of going in the wrong place or making this mistake or that mistake, it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Right? But we don't think at the larger scale. We think very, very little, very
narrow-mindedly.
And usually, we rather than living our life and enjoying it, we think about how other people view us. And so we end up sacrificing, you know, our life and sacrificing our happiness for other people's, you know, happiness.
All of us in this modern life have been like this. I guess this modern life and its speed has turned us into these horrible
creatures. Yeah, the modern life is all about. Well, that's a bit harsh. It's a bit harsh on ourselves, I guess. But yeah, this is what the modern life is about. It's about comparing yourself to others. It's about how you look. Mm-hmm. It's all about how you look and what you have, right? Because the modern world, like, there's no hiding it.
Prioritizing my needs and how to differentiate between the things that are trivial and the things that are important is a difficult task.
It's a difficult task, yeah.
And I guess
difficult for us as Muslims, by the way. It shouldn't be difficult as Muslims, because I always say this, that we Muslims, we have a very clear path. We know exactly what we need to do and what we shouldn't do in most things in life.
Yeah.
Right? Because that was the whole point of Islam, right? Islam, Allah gave us instructions. Allah knew that we're going to be lost on our own, right? And that human beings on their own can't do this. So Allah sent us guidance. And for us as Muslims, we have our guidance. We more or less know what we should do and what we shouldn't do in most things in life. When it comes to others, I can understand why they think why they're lost. Because they don't have that guidance. So it makes sense to them. They're lost in life, so they're trying to find happiness. And they're trying different things.
Yeah.
Well, we have the instructions. We just don't follow it. We're just not ready to accept that this is the right way towards our happiness.
Or let me just put it this way. As for me, for a believer, I'm a believer. I know the path. But sometimes I don't call it just getting out of the track or getting deviated. But sometimes, you know, it's hard to keep up with your beliefs. You know what I mean? I mean, I know that I should leave everything to God's decision and providence.
Yeah.
And I know that he would do whatever that is the best for me. But still, I am worrying about my future.
Yeah. But you see, in this case, it would be worrying about the important things, right? When you have this kind of focus, and by the way, when I say instructions of God, I mean when we understand them properly, right? This assuming that we're talking about the correct beliefs and the correct guidance and so on. Then what happens is then you worry about life, but about the important things in life, the things I really should be worried about.
Yeah.
Not the trivial things, right? And that actually makes you a better human being. That actually is the good type of thinking or overthinking.
Exactly.
Right? And I don't think it's a bad thing to overthink important things. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think important things need to be overthought. But obviously, there's also a way to go about it. We should seek counsel. We should, you know, see how it...
mentors, someone who could help us.
Exactly. If we have mentors, if we have the right person to speak to, we think about things, we do our research, you know, we take responsibility of our actions. And at the same time, we also rely on God. And this is the thing that really gives you that comfort. That, look, when I do my best, by the way, tawakkul and trusting Allah doesn't mean that you don't do anything, you just leave it to Allah. It means that you trust Allah. At the same time, you do what you're supposed to do. You carry out your responsibility. So you've thought things really properly and you've sought guidance for it. And then you do it with that tawakkul. Then if things don't work out well, you would have that peace of mind. You would have that tranquility in your heart. Look, I did my best. So there must be, like we say, khair, inshallah.
And I'm relying on you. So exactly. I do my best and I'm relying
and
on you.
And if it doesn't work out, then you don't lose that inner peace because, you know, you understand that there's definitely khair. There's definitely good in this.
This must have been the best choice for
me. Exactly, yeah. So I think that thing that Islam gives us is that is really that key towards that peace of mind, right? That you take your actions, you think about things and so on. And then when things don't turn out the way you wanted, it still doesn't bother you.
Yeah, so you're let's able to go cope with it. For much of thinking and then come back after the break. You're listening to Youth Station. I'm Asma, me and Brother Abu Zahra. We're talking about overthinking. And then we talked about the reasons and the causes of overthinking. Let's talk more on how to overcome it. Well, one of them was to have reliance on Allah and then do my effort. And then whatever happens, believe it and make sure that this was the best for you.
And the other thing was about having a mentor and seeking guidance. Mentor, asking people for their experiences. And, you know, using your knowledge, your thinking, and other people's experiences to be able to get away with things.
So as for myself, when I get into the process of overthinking, I try to engage myself with some sort of tasks that are going to be useful for me. Like, I don't know, I am translating a book. So whenever I have troubles and problems and traumas, I just go to it and do my translation.
And yeah, so one of the ways is, you know, distract yourself. You know, make yourself busy. And then when you're at a better mental state and emotionally more stable, then you come back and think about it properly and rationally.
Yeah.
And I feel writing things down also really helps. Makes your thinking much clearer. Yeah.
Imagine you're on a break, then you can go for a short journey or travel. You can go for a walk if the journey and traveling is not available for you. Then you can go for a short walk. You can change your situation, go for anything different. And engage yourself in new stuff that could just change your way of thinking. When there are some times that have been after that problem or issue that has happened to you, then you could see that, okay, there were some other solutions for me. Why I didn't notice them? That the problem could have been solved pretty much easily. Why I was so much blind not to see all those
and
ways.
And often in the middle of the problem, you make the problem too big, right?
Exactly.
It seems like the only thing in the world that matters.
Yeah. You know? It seems like you're the only one in this world who's suffering from this huge problem, but that's not the truth about the case. So, yes, we were talking about overthinking. Overthinking is bad when it is about trivial things, when it is about mundane things, when it is about some stuff that are not just worthy of spending too much of time on them. But overthinking about important things, as in to improve yourself, as in to be a better soul, as in to achieve more of, you know, evolvement in your character or personality. These things are, to overthink about these things is sort of justified, but about the trivial things of this mundane life is not justifiable any way you look at it.
And overthinking about, you know, difficulties that you come across and stuff, again, that makes sometimes the problem worse.
Exactly.
And I think one thing that really helps as well is to ask yourself, if I keep thinking about it and if I dwell on it, is it going to make a difference?
Yeah.
Right. And you remind yourself that, look, however much I think about it, at the end of the day, right now, it's not in my control. Just forget about it. Yeah. You know, take a step back, forget about it, we'll come back to it later, right?
Exactly.
Because my continuing to think about it is not going to make a difference. It's not going to solve it. It's not. In fact, it's going to make it worse because I'm making it a big deal in my mind. It's difficult, but when you think about it like this, then you're able to sort of step back, take a step back, and like you said, you know, travel, do something, keep yourself busy. And that really helps to empty your mind.
Sometimes it's good to embrace the problem right at the moment. But sometimes it's good to procrastinate things. I mean, delay it. Just put it off. Put it for another time.
Yeah.
Give yourself a break. And then after 2 days, 3 days, whatever time you wish to take, come back to it. And you could see that it's pretty much easier. And at least it's not as difficult as you thought it
would
be.
It makes more sense.
Yeah, it makes more sense. Okay, thank you, brother, and thank you to your listeners.
Thank you
for staying with us. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.